History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. On September 20th, 1519, Ferdinand Magellan set out with 5 ships and 270 men on behalf of the Spanish crown to find a western route to Asia through the Americas to establish a spice trade route alternative to the eastern route around Africa and avoid the Portuguese. Of the 270 that set out, only 18 returned. Men died of mutinies, starvation, scurvy, storms, and hostile encounters with indigenous people. Magellan himself died in a battle in the Philippine Islands, and the voyage was completed by Juan Sebastian Elcano. Well, in the early age of exploration, death rates like these weren't uncommon. Disease was omnipresent because the conditions on ships were absolutely filthy. Provisions were also a concern. You didn't know where you were able to get clean food and water because you didn't know what ports were available on your voyage. Without a proper diet, this led to malnutrition or scurvy, which is caused by lack of vitamin C. If you're on a voyage where most of your crew died, in some ways you are actually one of the lucky ones. Many voyages were simply lost at sea due to poor maps and navigation techniques that weren't designed for circumnavigation of the world. Hurricanes and tropical storms were always a concern. Ships could become marooned and have to wait until they can make repairs or replenish supplies before sailing again. In 1498, Henry Cabot, who was trying to find the Northwest Passage, was simply lost at sea, and his fate is unknown. Well, some would argue in the space age, there's a similar type of danger as in the age of exploration. In the last half century, about 30 astronauts and cosmonauts have died while training or attempting dangerous space missions, notably in the Apollo 1 mission, the Challenger explosion, and other Soyuz rockets. What's interesting to note is that the vast majority of these deaths occurred either on the ground or in Earth's atmosphere, below the boundary of space called the Kármán line. Of the roughly 550 people who have gone into space, only 3 have actually died there. Interestingly enough, some have argued that we are too risk-averse when it comes to exploration. One of those people is today's guest, Rand Simber. Rand is an aerospace engineer and an entrepreneur and consultant in space technology and business development. He's also the author of the book, Safe is Not an Option: Overcoming the Futile Obsession with Getting Everyone Back Alive That is Killing Our Expansion into Space. Now, Rand isn't glib about safety. He takes it very seriously with space exploration. What he's arguing is that throughout the history of human exploration, risk is simply the cost of doing business. He says that in the history of exploration and establishment of new lands, science and technologies have always entailed risk to the health and lives of explorers. But when it comes to exploring and developing the high frontier of space, the harshest frontier ever, the highest value is apparently not in the accomplishment of these goals, but of minimizing, if not eliminating, the possibility of injury or death of the humans carrying them out. So when you get down to it, there's always an actuarial table of cost versus risk, and he says that this is lopsided. And again, this isn't to put to danger those who are undergoing these missions, but it's to accept the optimistic humanistic vision of human exploration, that humans have always voluntarily and willingly take on great challenges for the pursuit of learning and discovery, and we shouldn't stop those people who are wanting to do such things. If there are those who are willing to risk death for free solo rock climbing, why not have similar people do the same thing if it means the discovery of new worlds? This question of risk versus reward is one that in some ways applies equally to the 1500s as it does to today. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Rand Simber. Rand, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, and we're going to begin with something that is near and dear to my heart, and it's also mentioned in your book, and that is the Age of Discovery, and also the voyages, the dangers that came with the voyages during this time period. With someone like Marco Polo, he was as safe as he could be. He had the diplomatic protection of the Mongolian Khanate, but he still suffered disease, starvation, cold. Ibn Battuta, who traveled from North Africa to the Indian subcontinent and beyond, was shipwrecked numerous times, was attacked by pirates, and we can get into Captain Cook and everything else. But so to frame our current space age and to maybe get a bigger picture of risk assessment, could you talk about the dangers of voyages in the age of discovery with people like Magellan and others?
Well, as I say in the book, there were lots of ways to die at sea. And a lot of people found pretty much all of them. or not. I mean, obviously no one person found them all because you can only do one. But yeah, I mean, you're, from a health standpoint, the nutrition standpoint, you know, they didn't know about scurvy. They didn't know about, you know, basic supplements that they needed, dietary things. They were living on, you know, dried cod, not getting enough vitamin C. In fact, that's why Brits are called limeys, because in the Navy, they gave them limes to get them, once they figured this out, to give them that. But I mean, that's like the least of their problems, you know, rickets and scurvy. You know, you had pirates, you had storms, you had just shipboard accidents. Somebody's foot could get pulled in an anchor rope and get pulled overboard. And then, of course, you had the dangers of just living on a crew with a bunch of men, you know, who were tended, particularly young men, who tended to fight over stuff. So I guess the question to me is, how much of that is going to, are we going to see in space? And I think the answer is probably a lot of it. And as I was mentioning to you before we started talking on the show, I was actually moderating a webinar this morning on the future of medicine in space. And we were talking about all the issues, the health issues that we know people have from extended period and free fall. And it's basically, it's like it ages you very, very rapidly. And they discovered that with the twin study, with the Kelly twins. Fortunately, it's you can be rejuvenated mostly by coming back to Earth. But they're going to have the same kind of health issues, and we're trying to sort that out. We don't know what the equivalent yet of the vitamin C and the limes is going to be for space travelers. But that was a time where people, you know, life was cheaper. You know, we're much more risk averse in general today than obviously they were then. And they were seeking lots, you know, seeking various rewards. There was a lot of them wanted to get rich. A lot of them wanted to convert the heathens. I think the saying was gold, glory, and God. That's what they were doing it for. And particularly if you're a believer in God, then maybe you don't fear death as much.
Yeah, very different calculus. And I'm glad you mentioned the scurvy point, because I was interested to learn that with the voyages of Captain Cook, the Royal Society bestowed upon him membership, of course, for the contributions he and his crew made to geographic knowledge, but almost as much for determining the nutritional requirements to avoid scurvy, which plagued these long distance voyages. So I'm curious, what you talk about in your book is this ongoing calculus of trying to mitigate risk, but also accepting that as something inevitable when it came to doing these voyages of discovery. And this isn't, determining this balance isn't something new. Different governments in the past had to also find their own balance. And were there any other stories that stuck out to you, whether what Edward Shackleton was trying to do or the British voyages tried to discover the Northwest Passage, like John Franklin, where the crew got stuck in ice and basically starved to death, or anything else that when you saw that in the past, you thought, okay, this is a similar thing to what governments are trying to figure out today?
Well, one other story, which you may not be familiar with, is there's a book called Sea of Glory, and it's about some kind of expedition, but it was an American mission. Can't remember the captain's name at this point, but he discovered he was the first person probably to see Antarctica. And this was in the early part of the 19th century. I think it was like the 1830s. But I highly recommend that book because it describes all of his trips. And he went all the way down, went to the South Seas, saw the, oh, in fact, a few, there's a peninsula named after him. So if I looked at a map of Antarctica, I'd remember what his name is. It's the, you know, it sticks out fairly far north. But so he was in the South Seas. He went to Hawaii. He climbed Mauna Loa, I think it was Mauna Loa. He but he sort of rediscovered the mouth of the Columbia. It was actually discovered by seal trappers. And he had a mutiny, and he ended up being court-martialed when he got back, you know, for his cruelty to the men. But, you know, it's certainly that voyage encapsulates, I think, a lot of things that can go wrong on a trip like that. But the other notable thing did was that the collection of stuff that he brought back was the original, started the Smithsonian. But it's a story not many people know about because it was sort of such a scandal at the time. It's like a bit of forgotten American history because nobody really wanted to publicize it.
Those stories of Arctic explorers or Antarctic explorers, at least to me, that sounds like one of the worst fates you could have if you're a space explorer. I mean, of course, many bad things can go wrong, but I suppose The worst is there's decompression, and then you are sucked out into space and die, and it's over relatively quickly versus months and months and months of malnutrition and freezing and starving and mutiny. So,
yeah, well, and it's interesting to compare Scott and Amundsen.
Hmm. Yeah, right.
In terms of the risk versus reward. And, you know, a lot of people say that my book says, oh, we should just be, you know, reckless, which is not what the book says. You know, you have to balance risk against reward. But you have to, you know, and that's going to be an individual decision. It can't be, you know, NASA has basically an arbitrary requirement that they had, which is one of the reasons the commercial crew was delayed for so long. They had to hit, I think it was like 1 in 320 chance of loss of crew.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a one size fits all. It doesn't matter what the crew is doing, whether they're doing science fair experiments or they're going out to save the Earth from an asteroid. You know, it's the same risk. That was the allowable risk, and they had to get to that level to NASA satisfaction before they would let them fly.
Actually, you mentioned Scott and Amundsen, which I've listeners have heard about their stories many times on this podcast before, and Amundsen is incredibly accomplished, and one of them is reaching the South Pole first. He does so. He and his team travel very lightly, whereas Scott, they bring along their scientific equipment. They're a little bit more bogged down. But was there a particular way you looked at them and tried to take the example of one or the other and apply it to space exploration?
I didn't deal with them in the book, other than talking about Amundsen Station.
Mm-hmm.
Or Amundsen Scott Station. And actually, technically, didn't Scott get there first? He just didn't get back.
That's the issue, yeah. This is an example. I forget all these things. I think Amundsen got there first.
Yeah, I've forgotten. But
yeah, exactly. So listeners, we're definitely not omniscient. So they're trafficking a lot of information. There's a lot that comes and goes. But yeah, so, please go ahead.
Well it kind of reminds me of comparing the rights to Smith to Langley, you know, in terms of Langley had this big government grant, you know, to build an airplane, and he was a physicist, you know, wasn't really an engineer, and he spent, you know, he would hire people to build this thing, and it kind of took a NASA-like approach, you know, where he would analyze it and say, okay, this is what we think we need, this is what we think will work, and the first time he launches the thing off the houseboat in the Potomac, it just, you know, sinks like a sack of cement.
Yeah.
Whereas the Wrights were, they're inventors, and they were tinkerers, and they were experimenters, and they basically invented the science of aviation. So I think it's the same thing. I think with Amundsen and Scott, I think Amundsen gave it a lot of thought and a lot of careful planning, but figured out the key was, like you said, to travel light, and and you eat the dogs, and it worked. The analogy I always make about how NASA would have opened up the West is if you imagine that there was no, you know, there was no forage, there was no food, there was no water, you know, between St. Joe and Oregon. So the NASA approach would be to build like a giant Conestoga wagon, and they'd have like 300 cattle, oxen, pull the thing, you know, and it would just barely just be able, and then because it would have to carry all the supplies that everybody needed, everything to feed the oxen, everything to feed the people for the whole trip all the way across the country. And for the first start, it would be going very slowly. So it's, you think of almost like a rocket, you know, that you're staging. And so as you go on and on, it gets lighter and lighter, and you don't need as many oxen. So you kill one, and then you kill another, and you eat the oxen as you go. But basically, it'd be SSTO, single stage to Oregon, right? You know, whereas, you know, the right approach is you figure out how to fuel. You figure out how to find the stuff you need on the way. You know, we're going to need to do the same in space. As I say, you're going to want to refuel early and often. But that gets back to, again, the Scott versus Amundsen approach. You know, he took a more NASA-like approach, and Langley took a more NASA-like approach, where you analyze and analyze and analyze. Whereas instead of just thinking about the basic problems, say, what's the easiest way to do? What's the most effective way to do this?
And the Wright brothers, I suppose, to their credit, when Langley died, I believe he got a little bit of humor and ribbing in different obits that he had this failed approach to flight. But the Wright brothers said, well, this is how technological advancement happens. It's a lot of people trying different things. But when I read the description, I think it was in a David McCullough book, it sounds like What came to my mind were the old-timey footage that sped up from the 19-teens or earlier, where people trying these ridiculous contraptions of attaching, you know, bird wings to their arm and trying to do gliders or whatever. It looks like a ballistic missile.
Airplanes with seven wings.
Right. I mean, hey, you have to break some eggs to make an omelet. So before coming to the first step of the space age, one thing real quickly, you had mentioned that you were part of a webinar that looked at future health problems in space. That sounds very intriguing because that links up to what we were talking about with the age of discovery and scurvy. What are people talking about the future? Osteoporosis or radiation or what?
Yes. It's the free fall causes all kinds of problems, and it's turning out it's actually causing brain injury. Because of the way the fluids aren't being pulled down to your feet properly, so they build up in the head, and you have there's an increase in intracranial pressure. And that's where I learned something new today, in fact, from this doctor from Nottingham, who said that your eyes are actually an extension of your brain. They're part of your brain. So when you look at somebody's eyes, you're actually looking at their brain. It's the only part that you can see. But that intracranial pressure puts pressure on the optic nerve, apparently, and that's why they're having vision problems. But they're having other neurological issues, and they are having bone decomposition, muscular, if they call, there's a word for it, but you lose muscle. You lose muscle mass, you lose bone. It is very much like aging. And so they're trying, the organization I'm working with right now, they actually started out as a longevity organization, and then they branched into space. But they're very interested in this because they think, in fact, I don't know if you've ever talked to Jim Caravalla from Offworld.
I don't believe so, no.
Yeah, he was. We did another webinar on the same topic 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago. It was on the 29th of September, I think. And he was one of the panelists, and he pointed out that the effects of aging, the effects of space, he said he wouldn't say they're one and the same, but there's a lot of coincidence to them. There's a lot of commonality. And that if we figure out how to fix one, we'll probably be able to figure out how to fix the other. So that would be nice if in the process of trying to figure out how you get people to live longer, be healthier in space, we get to live longer on Earth as well.
Very interesting. I mean, there's a lot of money, I suppose, in gerontology, so that could very well lead to future missions if there is money in there.
Yeah, unfortunately, people are actually starting to, I think they're actually recognizing now that aging is a disease, which, and the fact that they wouldn't recognize that previously made it a lot harder to get government grants because, you know, there was just kind of taking a fatalistic approach, say, well, people get old, you know, that's not something we can fix, so let's not waste money on it. But there are people now, there are companies, there is money going into these longevity companies.
So coming up to the early stages of the space age, the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs, and also the early stages of the Soviet program, and I forget the name of the director, but I know that he was very much a risk taker and had more of a Wright Brothers approach. So could you tell me about the early stages of NASA and the Soviet space program and their approach to risk?
Well, the thing that it's important for people to understand is that NASA was not risk averse at the beginning. And the reason they weren't was because it wasn't really about space. It was about, it was a battle in the Cold War. And it was in the Cold War for many, many thought that it was an existential war. You didn't want to lose it. So they were willing to take risks. The astronauts, you know, Buzz and Neil probably figured they had maybe a 50-50 shot of coming home alive. But there was, you know, so it wasn't this 1 in 320 loss of crew. It was like 50-50. And they were willing to do that. You know, we really won the race with Apollo 8 in 1968 at Christmas. Because NASA was willing to, the LEM wasn't ready, but they said, but you know, we could send some people around the moon. We can beat the Russians with that because they were afraid that the Russians had sent animals around the moon. And they're afraid they were going to send a man. So they figure here's something we can actually beat the Russians, because they've been losing. The Russians had all the firsts pretty much up to that point. You know, first man in space, first man in orbit, first woman in space, even going back to the dogs, first spacewalk. You know, they've been doing the first everything, but this was a chance to beat them at something. Tom Paine decided, you know, let's send Apollo 8 to the moon. And remember that the last time the Saturn V had flown all up, it had been kind of a disaster. that had vehicle, there's structural damage, there are all kinds of things. They had pogo, there are all kinds of things that they had to fix. And they put crew on that flight, that next flight, Saturn V flight, and sent them all the way around the moon. So you cannot imagine, you know, today's NASA could not do that.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Yeah, and just to review it, so in Apollo 8, that's when a crew orbits the moon. They don't land. That's Apollo 11. But what were the problems that they had with the Saturn V rocket in the previous launch?
Well, they lost an engine, at least one of the F1s, I think, and they had pogo, which is where the structure goes into an oscillation, and it actually did structural damage to the vehicle. So it was, but afterwards they looked at it, they analyzed it. Well, we know why that happened. We know how to fix it, and they fixed it. But they didn't do a test flight. They just put crew on the next one because they didn't want the Russians to beat them around the moon.
Yeah, I think there's obviously the Cold War space race element, and Tom Wolfe famously wrote in The Right Stuff that it was sort of a modern day version of medieval combat where you have one person designated as a hero to engage in single combat against the champion of another city or nation. It sounds like El Cid or something like that.
Right.
So yeah, these astronauts are the champion of their city. Based on your reading of that history, and I'm sure talking to many people in the space program, is that Tom Wolfe taking some literary license, or do you think there's some truth to that?
No, I think there is truth to that. I mean, it was, you know, there's a phrase people have, I can't remember, it was a moral alternative to war, something like that. But that was the idea. It's better that we engage in this gladiatorial thing, flexing our technological muscles, than it is to fling nukes at each other.
Can't argue with that. That's good logic. One other thing, too. Because you're an expert in this field, there was something interesting I read. This was after the recent Virgin Galactic launch, or the first one where Richard Branson went had a suborbital flight, and it was a two-stage airplane, then airplane to rocket. And there were some who were saying that, you know, maybe it was a mistake to abandon the X-1 or these types of the first supersonic flights. We could have really gone somewhere, but then we became so fixated in the 1960s from incredibly expensive and single-use rocketry that did work, but only worked really well when you were just funneling billions and billions of dollars and 2-4% of the entire GDP into NASA. Maybe if we would have stayed with these different stage airplanes, we might have, you know, gone somewhere else. Like, what's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I've written about that, and yeah, the X-15 was supposed to be just the first, and there were supposed to be follow-ons, and this is all happening at the same time, right? The late 50s. Early 60s, but then all of a sudden this space race happened, and we had to get there in a hurry, and we were willing to. The old saying was, you know, waste anything but time.
Mm-hmm.
So they were willing to throw a lot of money at it, and so in our rush, we put people up on munitions, and then we had to come up with this idea of human rating. Back then we called it man rating them, which meant because ballistic missiles are not. Hey, nobody really knew how reliable they were. Fortunately, we never found out. But they didn't have to be highly reliable because they would, you know, target more than one. They would put more than one missile on a target. So if half of them got through, they're still going to do the job. But you can't put a person up on something that's maybe only got a 50-50 shot. So they would have to go through and really beef up the reliability, track all, you know, you want to track the metal almost all the way back to the mine for quality. You just do have a lot of quality control, putting in additional redundancy, all this stuff that made some, you know, relatively cheap missile quite a bit more expensive. But, you know, so I always say that the space race in Apollo really put us on a bad path. We would have been a lot better off if we just continued, you know, slowly, more gradually, more naturally, and using American free enterprise, not this big, massive socialist program. It created a paradigm for everybody that this is how you do space. And you can still see it with things like SLS. NASA or Congress cannot conceive of a NASA that doesn't own and operate its own launch vehicle.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's still, I mean, sometimes it just takes once in a while to step back and think how ridiculous it is that you have a rocket that is as tall as a skyscraper in a mid-population American city. It's all thrown away. The only thing that's left behind is a capsule that's maybe the size of a Honda Civic. I don't know. It's bonkers. Like, how much is wasted when all of that goes up and go down, but we accept it as normal because it's precedent.
Yeah. And I point out, in fact, I have an essay out in the New Atlantis, just in the fall issue, just came out. I think it's only available to subscribers right now, but it'll go probably come out from behind the paywall sometime in the next few weeks. Probably timed to some kind of space event, a launch event, like if Elon actually flies Starship, probably time it to that. But it talks about that, how it's as expensive it is to get stuff into space, it's even more expensive to get it back. Because if you think about what was on top of that Saturn V, you know, the only thing that came back out of that, all of that, those thousands of tons of vehicle and propellant, was a capsule, three guys, and a few hundred pounds of rocks.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, just that this is the paradigm we've gotten used to. And something I'm curious about is, how would you compare the safety of, let's say, NASA at its most risk tolerant, when Buzz and Neil and Michael Collins were drinking their old fashions and driving their Corvettes and going to the launch pad, the sort of like most cowboy macho era of NASA, versus today's safety protocols that are used on the ISS? So how would you compare those two different eras?
Well, the way I compare them is, as I said, in Apollo, space was important, and now it's not. I mean, clearly, if it was important to have ended our dependence on the Russians to get us, you know, to the ISS after we retired the shuttle, we would have flown a lot sooner. The reason it took until May of 2020 for the first flight of the commercial crew is because NASA insisted on, they didn't want more than 1 in 320 chance of losing an astronaut. Now, we know we had a lot higher chance of that back in the 60s, and we were willing to accept it because it was a Cold War. It was a war. But it just tells you that space isn't really important. They're not willing to risk an astronaut's life. You know, in the book, I quote Jerry Purnell, who said once at a conference, I think, that apparently astronauts are not national heroes, but they're national treasures, too valuable to be risked on something as hazardous as human spaceflight. Okay. And I think, in fact, John Young was in the audience, and I think he squirmed a little bit when he heard that.
So, I mean, I think a critic who doesn't, like, very deeply engage with the source of your book will say, well, this sounds like you're being glib with human life, which I know you're not, but how would you respond back to that criticism?
Well, I say it may sound like that, but I'm not being glib, but I am recognizing that there are things worth risking life for, which apparently NASA cannot. Congress won't, and it's not NASA's fault, it's Congress. Congress won't let them. You know, there was I forget his name, but at the time, the penultimate flight, the last, second to last flight of the shuttle, the chairman of the science committee or science or space subcommittee told Charles Bolden, you know, I'm glad you took all these measures to make sure that we didn't lose any astronauts. And, you know, but people don't understand that the reason we retired the shuttle wasn't because it killed astronauts. You know, we have astronauts coming out the wazoo, and there's plenty more who would be happy to sign up, you know, if they don't want the job. But we couldn't afford to keep losing orbiters because we couldn't build anymore. They cost a couple billion each. You know, all the tooling was gone. Fundamentally, we retired it not because it was unsafe, but because it was unreliable. You cannot have a reusable vehicle that's unreliable. It makes no economic sense.
I'm curious, let's say that you were able to re-engineer, you know, leaving Starship and other things out of the equation during this era that you were focusing on, that it was, you would argue, over-engineered. The safety protocol was so high that it was limiting the possibilities of what NASA could do with its constrained budget. How would you have re-engineered the space shuttle or other rockets that NASA used to find this balance between risk versus functionality?
I'm not sure I have an answer to that question. I haven't even really given it a lot of thought. I think what I would have done is encouraged private competition and buy services from them. Mm-hmm. The problem with shuttle wasn't its design. I mean, it was a bad design, but the problem with it was the notion that we were going to have a single launch system, because that was the plan. They wanted to retire Titan and Delta and all, you know, they wanted to retire all the Air Force launch vehicles and just rely on the shuttle, that we were going to have a single national space line to get everything into space. And that was, in retrospect, and I think, you know, for me, even at the time, that seemed crazy.
So coming up to the modern era from the 1960s up until today, I suppose, what is the cart and what is the horse? And what I mean by that is this risk aversion, this growing risk aversion, is because society in general is more risk averse. We have longer life expectancy. We have more vaccines, more surgeries, other things that can keep us safer longer. And that also affected how we view our space exploration program, or were there things within the program itself and the culture of NASA that caused people to think in a more risk-averse way? What do you think led to this cultural shift?
Well, I think it's both. And I do. Yeah, we are, as I said, back, life was held to be much cheaper back in the age of exploration. And we are, as a society, much more risk-averse. But as individuals, there are still a lot of individuals who are willing to take risk. And I talk in the book about all the things, the crazy things that people do, climbing Everest, free diving, you know, wingsuiting. All these things are things that, you know, people die every year doing these things. But we don't, and that's the argument I make for why we shouldn't be regulating commercial rocketry for safety. Because A, we don't know how, and B, different people have different risk tolerances. I wrote a piece several years ago for National Review. I think it was after that, the German wings thing, you know, where basically that everybody on that plane died because they'd armored the cockpit doors after 9/11 and the co-pilot locked it so nobody could get in. So in order to make themselves safe, they actually introduced a new hazard. And the point I made was that, you know, airlines are not allowed, they can compete on, you know, how big a bag of peanuts you get, or how good looking the flight attendants are, or on price. But the one thing they're not allowed to compete on is safety. Everybody has the same expectation. They're supposed to have the same expectation. The FAA makes sure that they do, that when they get on that airplane, they're going to get off the other end. But right now, I think we are in a period where safety has to be one of the things that people compete on.
Right. And in a way, I mean, there's sort of an insurance actuarial table there. And you mentioned that different people do have different risk tolerances. So the documentary Free Solo of the rock climber who climbs at El Capitan in Yosemite National Park with no safety gear whatsoever, and you're physically tightened up as you're watching that entire documentary. And it's found in the film that the rock climber in an MRI scan has literally part of his brain that's atrophied, and it's a center that produces fear. So he's like a Vulcan when he is faced with danger. He simply analyzes it and he reacts accordingly, which is what makes him such a good free solo rock climber. But that's an example of someone who has extraordinarily high risk tolerance. So I'm wondering, like, what you, as we move into the world of private rocketry with SpaceX, with the launch costs coming down to $200 a kilo, I think Robert Zubrin has even argued that if you look at the energy expenditure to get something to orbit, there's no reason it couldn't be $67 a kilo. Well, that's a whole different discussion right there. But now there's a whole new possibility. And if this is run all privately and we consider this, you know, along the same lines as extreme sports, let's say, the government doesn't stop anyone from, you know, free solo rock climbing as long as you sign a stack of documents that you're not going to sue anyone. It's sort of, you can kind of do almost anything. So what's your actuarial table of balancing risk identification, risk mitigation, and overall cost? So do you have a back of the napkin actuarial table when you think about all these different things?
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
No, because as you say, it's going to be an individual thing, but that's the regime we're in right now, fortunately, and we're trying to maintain it. It's an informed consent regime. There is no, the FAA, unlike the aviation side, the FAA does not do mission assurance for launch, either for satellites or now for people. They're basically saying you're flying at your own risk. And, you know, all they require is that you be informed. Here's how the rocket works. Here's all the ways it can give you a bad day. Here's what we think the likelihood of any of those things happening is. You know, and you could do a probabilistic risk analysis and say, okay, so we think this rocket, and that's because that's what NASA did for commercial crew. They basically did a PRA and said, okay, we estimate that it's now less than 1 in 320. And so we'll let you put NASA astronauts up on it. But each, you know, it's a, you know, Virgin Galactic has a completely different approach than Blue Origin. You know, there are different ways. In fact, they, after I wrote the book, you know, I said one of the ways that you can have a bad day with that vehicle is that if the feathers deploy prematurely. And sure enough, that's what happened. You know, and they killed a co-pilot and severely injured the pilot, and they lost the vehicle. So that was just one way. At the time, Armadillo was still talking about flying, and you know they were going to go up, and I think they were going to land vertically. They were going to do the same thing basically that Blue Origin does, except without the capsule. It was going to be a single stage to suborbit, if I recall correctly. It was years ago. I mean, Blue Origin has a thing where the capsule comes down on chutes with I think a final burst, you know, just to soften the blow when it lands, and the first stage lands vertically like a SpaceX booster. So there are three, you know, completely different ways of doing things. It's not like with airplanes where we kind of did in the 20s and 30s, we sort of figured out, okay, this is basically what an airplane looks like. It's got two wings, not a biplane. It's got, you know, standard empennage with a horizontal and vertical stabilizer. You can mount the engines above or below, but that's a minor variant. You know, things got kind of, because it was, there was like sort of a Cambrian explosion of aircraft designs in the 20s. There was all kinds of crazy stuff. And you were talking about earlier about all the silent movies showing all the things that people were trying back then. But after a while, we figured out what was working, what was the best way to do it, what were best practices. And the way we figured that out was by losing airplanes and losing people. So we're kind of in that stage right now in space. I don't believe that the FAA is smart enough to regulate it, to certify vehicles. And I don't think they should be. And there are some people that are going to say, well, I'm willing to take the risk. As I said, you could, right now, they can compete on the basis of safety. You know, if Virgin wants to go out and say, our vehicle is safer than Blue Origin's because, you know, X reasons X, Y, and Z, they can say that. You know, but you can't have Boeing saying, well, I shouldn't say Boeing, I should deal with an airline basis. You can't have Americans saying, well, we have cheaper flights and, you know, it's not quite as safe. So it takes your chances and you pay your price, right? They can't do that because the FAA says, this is what you shall do. This is how you shall operate this aircraft. This is how this aircraft shall be designed in order for you to fly the paying public.
I could see Ryanair in Europe advertising that. We're cheaper, we're not as safe, but it's something I really respect about Ryanair. They're just sort of, I don't want to say they hold their customers in contempt, but they make it very clear that this is a partnership. We're not at your service. So we're cheap, take it or leave it. Don't know if that's good or bad, but it's interesting.
I flew them from Luton to Bratislava a few years ago, and it was different.
Right. I think they wanted to remove some different seats and have people stand like a city bus, but that whatever the European FAA didn't allow that.
Yeah, the EASA.
Right.
Yeah, strap them to the wings, right? Well, that screws up the aerodynamics. Can't do that.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that of the airplanes. They eventually hit this convergent evolution where it determined this is simply according to the law of physics, the best way to describe to design a plane and what will happen with rockets. Or the same way that happened with the automobile sector, that after decades of trying to determine what's the most cost-effective way to produce a automobile that's safe, that doesn't have too much aerodynamic drag, cars all sort of look the same. So you don't have the same stylistic distinction like you do in the 50s, but, you know, that's how things evolved.
Pretty boring.
Yeah. No one really restores a 91 Honda or a, you know, 94 Ford Taurus. If they do, very interested to see. So I guess this gets back to the big theme, and this is the kind of like a grand question and what I'm trying to do on this mini series of linking the past, the age of discovery, to the future. And that's a question of the understanding human lives are going to be lost, but when people talk about this, sometimes, as we mentioned earlier, it can sound glib to the uninformed. But at the same time, there's also this very humanistic language and these humanistic aspirations talking that, well, we'll take humanity to the stars. All our eggs won't be in one basket. So we'll not only ensure the survival of our species, but lead to flourishing, much in the same way that people argue that with the age of discovery, it fueled the Renaissance. It led to new ideas. It exposed the West, which had been
arguably stagnant for a couple of centuries into the wider world, exposed it to different cultures, led to all these different types of flourishings we could talk about at length. So while on the one hand, you have horrendous death, you have people dying of scurvy as they're going on transatlantic voyages, or perhaps encountering hostile tribes, or seeing human sacrifices in Aztec ceremonial rituals, you also have something really, I think, exemplary taking place. So How do you think about these two different things, like risk versus, like, I don't know, the humanistic possibilities with this age of discovery coming up?
Well, as people came for different motivations, as I said, you know, God, glory in God. But another reason people came, if you think about the pilgrims, is they came for their notion of liberty. They wanted religious freedom because they'd been persecuted in Eastern England and East Anglia, and then they moved. And the Midlands too, I think. And then they moved to the Netherlands to get away from that, but then they didn't want their kids growing up speaking Dutch. They wanted to still be English. So they went to America. So that could be a kind of motivation, I think, for other people. But the idea is, for whatever reasons, we are going to bring life to the solar system. And ultimately, maybe the galaxy, depending on how the physics works out. And I think bringing life, not just humans, but life in general, because we're going to bring a lot of our animals with us, I assume. Otherwise, we won't have any meat unless we figure out how to make it in labs. I think that is actually a noble goal, and it's one worth risking life, because it's I say in the book, this is, people have always died opening frontiers. From the time we climbed out of the trees onto the savannah, that was a risky proposition. And then we moved out of Africa, and once technology developed, we moved into the Arctic. And now we're developing technology to go out into an entirely new harsh environment. And it's the harshest one we've ever faced, in human history. And it's nutty to think you're going to do that without loss of human life.
Right, absolutely. I mean, this is a timely question, but as we mentioned in this discussion, it's also a timeless one as well, and one that different societies have had to address in many different ways.
So, in fact, we have a contemporary version of it going on right now where people think that they can have zero COVID, and you can't have zero COVID. We're going to have to learn to live with it. And that means that some people are going to die from it. But people die from the flu every year. So we can't shut down our lives. You can't shut down our economies in a futile attempt to have zero COVID.
Yes. Respiratory diseases are tricky to maintain. That's for sure. Well, I mean, there's a lot to this. There's also a lot of history as well in your book of the 20th century and the space program and how it dealt with these issues specifically, both in the 60s and in more recent decades. And for listeners who want to check out the book, the name of the book is Safe Is Not an Option, Overcoming the Futile Obsession with Getting Everyone Back Alive That's Killing Our Expansion into Space. Rand, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
All right. That is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.